Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome
Hello,
to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Education, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name's Alice Garner. I'm based at the Melbourne Graduate School of Education in Australia, and I'm your host on the podcast today. I'm going to be interviewing Miriam Platinsky about her new book, Teach More, Hover Less, which was published recently. And Miriam is currently an instructional specialist with the Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland in the US. So we've managed our time zone negotiations, which is not always straightforward. So I'd love to welcome you to the podcast, Miriam.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here and that we worked out all those time zone negotiations.
Indeed. And a few technical hiccups along the way at my end. So, Miriam, perhaps you could give us a sense of your work to date, what's brought you here, and how you came to write this book.
So I have been, for most of my teaching career, classroom-based. I spent almost 20 years teaching what we call ELA, English Language Arts, and literacy-based courses here in the U.S. And about at that 20-year mark, I transitioned into school leadership, and then now I do what's called being an instructional specialist, which means I consult with schools in my district about all sorts of things, professional development, how we can address different needs for both students and teachers. So that's sort of my day focus. And then the way the book came about is that for many years, before I was a more experienced teacher, I was what I have termed in my book a helicopter teacher, someone who liked to really control the environment around me, who felt uneasy if things didn't go to plan. And what happened essentially was that I started teaching a course that changed all of that. And then one thing I found was that the method that had worked in one course started extending outward to all courses, and I wanted to find a way to capture that in a very practical way that teachers could act on. So the book, Teach More, Hover Less, is really written as a guide. It can be step by step, or you can pull out what you like, but the whole idea is that it has more ideas for activities and for strategies and tools than it does anything else, because that way we don't stay in that theoretical space. That was really my goal when I wrote it.
Yeah, and I would like to say that as someone who's been a high school teacher, I appreciated the – it seemed to me that you had pitched it perfectly for working teachers in both in the quality of writing and the accessibility of it, and the kind of practical suggestions that you make throughout. And I found it a really – kind of pleasurable read, actually, but also so many points of recognition. I saw myself so often in the teacher that you describe yourself to have been, but also others that you've worked with. And I love the at some point in the book you talk about you're inviting teachers to leave behind exhausting hyper control. And that really spoke to me. And I think that is something that many teachers fear and many teachers want to do, but don't quite know how to go about it. So I think this is what your book is addressing essentially, isn't it? It's, you know, how do you actually take that step?
Right. How do you turn it into action? Because that exhaustion, there's a reason that teacher burnout rates are fairly high. There's a reason that, you know, the profession itself on average sustains about 3 to 5 years for most people before they decide to do something else. And these are talented people who could go for a lot longer than they do. And so I really wanted to think about how many decisions do we make a day and how can we make fewer decisions so that students can make more, and how does that work to the benefit of everybody in the end?
Yeah, and I think it seemed that when you were writing the book, it was also coinciding with the COVID impact on education and how that required teachers to rethink their level of control as well.
Absolutely. It was a real game changer for a while, because if we thought we didn't have that much control when we were in buildings, what happened when the students weren't anywhere near us? And so initially I was thinking about proximity when I wrote this book. How do we create a classroom space that works with students so that whether we're with them or not, they are able to learn and take responsibility, a shared responsibility for their learning, even when we're not looking over their shoulders. So it was born during that time of thinking about that more. But honestly, it really applies now as we're back in schools and we're back in what looks more traditional. But at the same time, we still don't want to be on top of the kids. We want them to have their own space to learn and their own way to make meaning of what's happening.
Yeah, and I think as someone who taught in sort of quite open plan spaces, often with more than one classroom in that space, I think the possibilities, in a sense, having to deal with the remote learning means that perhaps teachers are now better able to conceive of working in those different sorts of spaces that may not be as enclosed or controllable as we perhaps experienced growing up.
Well, and it's also, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, it's rethinking what control means. What is control over our classroom? Is it that intense, you know, management, or is it really about something else?
Yeah, indeed. And so much of your book is about relationships as well, and what is the nature of that relationship, and what can you let go of? And what could you nurture? So perhaps we could work through. The book is structured in a particular way. So maybe we've already touched on this in a sense. You know, what is the mindset shift that needs to happen in teachers? You begin there to make this kind of teaching possible. Could you talk a little bit about the start of your book?
Absolutely. So the first stage of getting to what I call hover-free teaching is shifting the mindset away from I have to manage every piece of what students do, and letting them and believing that they can have this added role in their learning. And so to take teachers through that, it's not enough for me to say change your mindset. I actually think that's the most difficult thing to do. That's why I wanted to put that stage first, because whoever goes through this first stage in the book will really have a chance to think about their beliefs. For example, I have a list of look fors. I might be a micromanager if, and there's a whole checklist you can go through. And some of the things look rather innocuous. For example, one of them is I teach bell to bell. And a lot of teachers will think, well, that's a good thing. I'm planned out from the start to the lesson to the end of the lesson. Shouldn't I be doing that? Well, and yes. However, is there time and space for something else to occur if the opportunity presents itself, if a student has an idea that is related to the learning and that can take it in a different direction for a little bit? Do we have that agility or flexibility to go with them on that? And so that's one of the tools in that first section on stages. There are also some, you know, more fun. I sort of was imagining magazine with quizzes. There's a mindset quiz, you know, what do I do when students come into my class, and how do I handle being absent? And the idea is really to build awareness or self-awareness, and teachers can do this individually or they can do this in their teams. But what do I really think about my role in the classroom and students' role? And am I micromanaging too much? Is that what these tools and activities in this first section of the book are telling me? And if so, do I want to make a change? Because ultimately, shifting mindset means you have to come into it being open to the possibility that a different way might be better. And luckily, teachers are malleable. You know, we have this growth mindset approach where we always think we can be better, we can change, we're open to new approaches. But that's really where we start, because if we don't start there, then we can't move through the other parts of the hover-free teaching approach.
No, I think you're right. And you do talk a little bit about professional learning in your book and some of the frustrations that teachers have with that. And I certainly experienced that myself, that sense of, okay, that's all very well, but how am I going to apply that? And do I have time to process that and to do the work that enables me to make those changes? And there's so many, I think teachers feel so overworked that often the prospect of making real changes to your practice is just too hard. It's too hard to go there. So any methods of kind of opening that up and making it seem possible and desirable is so important, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more, especially once the school year starts. It's one thing to say to teachers, let's do some professional development over the summer when you have that luxury of thinking. But once the school year starts, you really need to pick and choose where you're going to make some changes. And that's why even though the book is written in four stages, you can flip around, find a strategy or a tool you like, adapt it for your classroom and use it the next day. That's really the goal.
And I think the story you tell of you having tried some of these things out with one class first and then made some discoveries and then felt that confidence about, you know, extending it beyond that group, I think is a good one to keep in mind.
Well, I always joke that the first class of the day is what I call the trial class. It's the one where you're trying your lesson for the first time. And then as the day goes on, the instruction changes. I also sometimes think that we're different teachers at different times of day with different students.
Just as students are, different people, different times of day and different days of the week and different subjects too. I think that's the other thing, isn't it? You see students in a very different light depending on which class they're in. So let's maybe think then about, let's go into that a little bit further, the mindset shift. What actually is required? Once you've done a quiz and worked out, I am a bit of a micromanager, where do we go from there?
For me, it always begins with picking one thing that we're going to change right away, because we don't really start to see the effects of, you can't change everything. It's just not tenable. So for example, if I start to realize that I have a habit of always writing out every portion of the lesson. And if a student comes up to me and says, hey, I know that you designed an assignment this way, but could I try it this way? I'm going to examine my own reasons for saying yes or no. I mean, I used to always say no. For example, I would say, no, this is the way I assigned it. This is the way we're going to do it. But what if they ask to do it differently and the learning goal will be reached either way? In other words, the way that I assigned it didn't necessarily make that much of a difference. It was more what I wanted them to learn. Then why don't I say yes more? So I could just start with one very simple action, like I'm going to say yes to doing things differently when and where I can. And I'm going to keep track of it. So when this happens, when a student does something that I'm not expecting, and I catch myself about to clamp down and say, mm-mm, instead, I'm going to see what happens, and I'm going to keep a tally or a running record or whatever you want to call it and see what the result was. What happened? So we're almost being scientists about our own practice, which we are anyway, but it's an intentional way to think about the way that we're shifting our approach to teaching. Or maybe the one thing I'm going to change is I will talk less. I am going to count to five every time I ask a question very slowly and see if it makes a difference, if people talk more. And I'll also count to five after a student says something and see if they elaborate or if another student jumps in. Just little actions to make big differences.
I think that's such a good tip. I certainly was someone who would end the day with a sore throat and think, I must talk less, I must talk less. But it's like it's not enough to say that to yourself. You actually have to develop little strategies and almost tricks for yourself, don't you? And counting certainly could be one. And in a way, perhaps too, in the planning, thinking about how can I do this and speak less. An intentional sort of reduction in teacher talk. Yeah. You move into the second stage of your book to talk about the importance of relationships. And we all know as teachers how crucial relationships are with students. And in fact, I think it's something that, it takes a little while to work out how important that is. I think you kind of know it intellectually perhaps in the first couple of years, and then as the years go on you realise that it is those students that you connect with that you see the greatest sort of changes in. And so could you talk a little bit about this stage two and how we go about developing deeper relationships with the students?
So in this section, I really reframe what we mean when we talk about a relationship. I'm not really talking about personal rapport or interaction. I think that's important and that we need to know who kids are as people, but I don't think it's what furthers the sort of classroom we want to build when we talk about being hover-free. For kids to share more of the work with us, they need to have a strong sense of what I call academic identity. So they need to feel as though their contributions to class, as scholars, as thinkers, as learners, that they are valuable. And unless we find ways to validate that, I might really enjoy talking to a student before a class. I think in the book, I talk about a student, I had a love of baking. We shared a love of baking with one another. But then I was never sure if I thought about it, whether that relationship we had really translated to her being comfortable with sharing things with me once the bell rang and we got underway with content, because I built one kind of trust, but not another. And so what this second stage is really about is how do we find ways to show students that we respect their opinions and that we value their ideas so that they have that trust in us. And when it comes time for us to say, well, let's share this together, they'll be more likely to get on that bus with us.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And you also use an example of, you know, a teacher who might, you know, kick the football with students at recess and they have a special rapport with a particular bunch of kids in their class, but that may not extend to other people and are some perhaps feeling that they are excluded or that they can't have that kind of relationship. So making that distinction between a sort of rapport and an academic connection, and I guess a sort of positive expectation from the teacher for each student about what they might be able to do. I think that's an important point. Have you found that, you know, because I think we can never have, there's so many different relationships that go on in one classroom and they change over time as well. And I think that it's possible as a teacher also to feel that you might have a connection with a student at one point and you lose it as you are developing better connections with other students. And I just thinking about the sort of moving away from needing to control things, could you reflect maybe a little bit on how we can think about those changing constellations of relationships?
Well, ideally, and this is my hope when building this sort of classroom space, because I saw it happen for my own classes. When students begin to do more, they begin to interact not just with the teacher more, but with one another. So what happens is that whereas a teacher-directed classroom, you've got a student-to-teacher relationship, but not necessarily student-to-student in that academic sense. Once you're building this classroom community of learners, what happens is the group dynamics become a lot more productive and functional to the point where, yes, it's true, you know, my relationship with individual students might be shifting, but as a whole, they are also relying more on one another. And I have more time and space to really feel less as though I'm playing that game of what we call whack-a-mole, you know, where you have one person at a time, and really work with true individuals or small groups or to have more frank conversations with students about where they are in their learning and to give them meaningful feedback on their work. So essentially the entire dynamic of the classroom is changing so that it's not anymore just about how I'm building these relationships, but we're doing it with one another. And when things are not going well, or when they do feel uneasy, we're able to have better conversations about it throughout the process so that I can say, you know, and this happened once with a student who'd been doing really well with me, and she just stopped doing group projects. She just said she was opting out. And finally one day, you know, and her classmates were frustrated with her. And I saw a group of kids talking to her and saying, "Where are you? We miss your voice. We miss your, you know, your take on things. The way that you frame these stories and these projects is so valuable. And what's happening?" They took care of it for me. And she was going through something, and I did talk to her about it, but it wasn't just my job anymore.
Yeah, that's powerful. And in fact, it's likely to have a stronger impact if the student feels that their peers are needing them to contribute.
Yeah, it's a different kind of accountability, I find. It's the same reason that I strongly feel that when we do professional development, the teacher should be leading that work, because a teacher is far more likely to listen to someone who's in the same situation that they're in than to, you know, some person who hasn't been in the classroom in quite a while. And not delegitimizing that person, but we learn very well from our peers and our colleagues.
I completely agree. I always felt that I learned the most from, in fact, the other teachers in the school where I was working, who had tried stuff out and wanted to share that. And, it's often very powerful. So moving on from the relationships, the next stage you explore, you call from engagement to investment. And I think, you know, there's a quote that I'll pull out of there, which is you say, if our aim is to reproduce learners just like us, our strategies will backfire. Now, this spoke to me because I think I was one of those teachers, as many are, who enjoyed school and had a certain idea about how, what was enjoyable and what was challenging and so on. And you know, as soon as you step into a classroom, you realise that, oh, no, there's a lot of students who don't see it the way I saw it, and how do I reach them? And so I think you address some of this problem or question in this chapter. Could you talk a little bit about what you want to get across in this section?
So this section is really about not relying on our assumptions and our intuitions as much as we do when it comes to how students are receiving our classes. You know, a lot of teachers were educated in a system that they didn't necessarily appreciate. I mean, some of us had good experiences in school and some of us didn't have such good experiences in school, but we will turn around and replicate the same thing because it's what we know, regardless. And so one thing that I challenge everyone to do when they're reading this book is to think about, you know, that traditional approach to the teacher knows and the student learns. Is learning not a two-way street in our schools, or is it a one-way process? Because if I want students to learn, I need, in my opinion, I need to know more about how that works. And so I'm not asking my students what to learn. I'm the teacher. I'm the one who's certified in a content area and also in pedagogy and all those things. So I'm still, you know, bearing that responsibility. However, I think it makes sense to ask students what works for them, what doesn't, what they know already, what they don't know, and not assume that they come to us with nothing to contribute. And so this section of the book is really about learning more from our students, whether it's when we're planning lessons, seeing what they already have so that we don't need to activate or reteach knowledge that they have already, so that we can move forward from there. And also getting not just their feedback, we all love doing surveys, but to use it in a way that's very transparent, so that if students make suggestions about the learning when we leave class one day, the next day I can tell them, well, here's what we're doing as a result of your feedback, or here's what we can't do, but here's why we're not doing it. So they have a much more active day-to-day role in how they learn as I'm guiding them through what they learn.
Yeah, I think that's so important to show that, you know, people are so bombarded by surveys these days that you really want it to be worthwhile. So I agree that you need to show that you've listened and see what you can apply. And I think you also have some really interesting points to make about due dates for assessments. And I think this is a really important one. I'd love you to talk a little bit about that.
So like most people who are listening to this, I'm sure we were raised on a culture of due dates and deadlines. And again, early years of my career, you know, we have that whole parallel of you need to turn it in by the due date because that's what we do as responsible adults. And it's very funny because when I started to manage adults who were saying these same ideas, kids need to turn things in on time, because I was managing teachers, they weren't turning things in on time, these adults. So it actually doesn't necessarily work the way that we tell students that it works. But the other thing is that due dates and deadlines are largely about compliance. Now, sometimes we can't change when something comes in because the end of a marking period is coming and grades are due and we don't have that flexibility. But when students turn work in late and we deduct points, we're grading a behavior. We're not grading a learning outcome. And it gets confusing for kids. It really does, because, you know, it's like the teacher who gets offended when a student's absent a lot and then does really well on a test. Why is that teacher so offended? Is it because the student wasn't there in class? In other words, their behavior wasn't good and they did well anyway? Because it seems as though if they're meeting the learning outcomes, then that was happening independent of our instruction. So maybe we need to revisit how we teach, or there are all sorts of things that could be happening. But this part of the book really talks about how we're so invested in compliance that we're not really looking at what's important a lot of the time, which is whether students are really engaged in our content, are learning it, and are focused on what the goal of our class is. Because we don't want to teach them that their job is just to behave a certain way. We want them to learn.
Mm. Yeah, I think that this is the thing, isn't it? Teachers feel so bound to particular schedules, and the notion that you could keep putting it off and allow the student more time. You know, I think quite often we might do that for particular students who we know are going through a difficult time at home, for example, and you make sort of accommodations. But to think of that as being a more general policy about let's just get the learning actually happening and evidence of that learning in a genuine way, I think that is actually quite a big shift to make. When you've talked about that with teachers who are working in specific systems, do you find that they're able to do that? Does the system that they're working in allow them that leeway?
Well, so it depends how rigid the system they're working in is. And the other thing is also, as I said, time is time. So, you know, if something has to come in by a certain date, you can't move that. And also, it's not fair to the teacher to constantly wait for the student to turn something in. It has to happen in a way that works for both student and teacher. But that's the thinking behind, in this section of the book, there's a what I call a you do you flexible calendar. And it has a series of points that all students have to meet by a very specific time. So the due dates are still there, but it gives them different ways to get there. So the calendar is a little flexible, but there's also an end point by which certain activities or projects or what have you have to be reached. And so not saying this is limitless, that they can just do whatever they want and turn things in whenever they want, but that we as teachers also question some of our rigidity when we can, especially if we're not fully aware. You know, you said we make exceptions for students who are going through something. We don't always know when students are going through something. They don't always tell us. And so to make that exception for one student and not for another. So instead, having a plan that involves really seeing more as it evolves in class. And that's another thing that I really talk about in this book is what can we do in class so that we as teachers know more, so that I can see a student building the work, and that when it finally gets to me as a grade, I've seen it enough that it doesn't take as long for me to give that focused feedback. So it's not about a free-for-all, because that would not work and that's not fair to anybody. It's more about just actively questioning, once again, the reasons why we say yes or no to things and what we can do to help kids who are genuinely trying to meet our learning goals.
Actually, this is something that you don't really discuss in the book, but I'm curious about your feelings about homework, because, you know, in a way that is very relevant to meeting deadlines, and some teachers manage to organise things in such a way that there's minimal homework and others rely heavily on homework, and it can be subject dependent as well. But I'm curious to know whether that's something that you've considered.
I consider homework from the dual perspective at this point in my life of parent and teacher. You know, I see what my children at home are doing, and then I also think about how in the past I've assigned homework and all the teachers I work with. And for me, homework needs to have a purpose beyond, once again, a compliance piece. So very often, you know, if kids are coming home and doing an activity that teachers then collect and grade for completion, in other words, they're not really looking at it, they're not really reading it, they're just checking it off. Why are we doing that? Is it it's the habit that we're grading? We're not grading the work. And, you know, I had this happen with my child. My child's in a math class, and the teacher can't tell me how my child's doing. And I said, well, how's he doing on the homework? Oh, well, I just checked that off. That's a completion grade. So why is he doing the homework then? Is there something more valuable he could be doing to learn these concepts so that when I meet with you, you can tell me how he's doing? So that's where I am with homework. It should make sense. I'm not going to ever tell a teacher they should or should not assign it. It's very, as you say, curriculum dependent, grade dependent, class dependent. If there's a purpose behind it, especially if you're thinking of sort of a flipped classroom model, it can be really useful to give students things to do at home. I don't think that you earn any what we would call street cred by keeping kids, you know, telling parents on back to school night, expect your child to do 2 hours of homework for me every night. Again, why? What's your purpose? So really think about the why with homework.
Let's move on. Given we're thinking about, I guess, assessment, whether it's formative, summative, or whatever we want to call it, in your next chapter, which is on choice-based instruction, one of the things you talk about is the way we might communicate to students the things that we're looking for in their assessments, and, you know, whether or not, and I was very interested in this because I've had lots of sort of mixed feelings about the way rubrics are used and the extent to which rubrics are, or the way that students might read them, what information is actually useful and what is just, you know, jargon that's there to kind of, I don't know, show that we've thought this through, rather than it being really about, not, I guess, you know, I'm having difficulty articulating it, but in a way it's about how can a rubric capture the possibilities of what a student might actually come up with, and how do we do this in a way that doesn't restrict them? Do you know what I mean by that question?
I think so. You'll know in a minute if I address the wrong part of it. But essentially, what I talk about in this section is what I call criteria for success. And this is a practice I strongly believe in, that when students have an assignment that's given to them, on the assignment, at the time that it is assigned, there should be a list written in student-friendly language of what they need to accomplish to be successful. If you think of your classic rubric, and it goes, let's say, from a 1 to 5, with the 1 being the lowest point of the rubric and the 5 being the highest. I cut out all the 1 to 4, and that 5 column is the criteria for success. So it's what the standard is that students need to meet to do well on an assignment. And if we as teachers don't know what that is going in, then I don't know how we can expect students to know that. One of the most resonant things that someone ever said to me was, students can't hit a target they can't see. And so often we are asking them to hit invisible targets. And the targets exist clearly in our own minds. Sometimes. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And so when it comes to designing a good rubric, I'm less concerned with telling them what they shouldn't do, which again are those less achieving, those lower achieving points, if you will, points on a rubric, and more concerned with telling them what they do need to do and making sure that they understand it in their own language and not in some kind of edu jargon. Is that the question that you were asking?
Yeah, and also I think you addressed the question about whether it's a good idea to share models or exemplars or not, because there's in the same spirit, and I'm thinking about, you know, if we want students to kind of take charge of their own learning and go where they're sort of, you know, have the possibility of expanding beyond even what we might imagine they might come up with, is showing an exemplar or a sample of this kind of project helpful, or actually can it have the opposite effect?
That depends on how much we want them to be creative, if for lack of a better term. There are times that exemplars really have a very useful purpose, which is when we're afraid that our assignment plus our criteria for success still isn't clear enough to show them what they have to do in a very explicit way. And so if we have that concern, giving them a sample or an exemplar is a good idea. But if we want things to be a little bit more open-ended, if we want them to take risks, if we're not looking for as rigid a product, then maybe just giving them a small piece of something or reading something to inspire it or just some kind of related concept. So, you know, this is where the teacher capacity really comes into play. You know, as teachers, we make, as I said earlier, so many decisions that it becomes exhausting. But we really need to think about, are we asking students to do things one way, and we want them to see the one way, so we're going to show it to them, which is fine. In many, many situations, that's what we want. Or are we trying to create something a little more open, in which case we have to be comfortable not controlling it to that extent?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there are sort of different elements, aren't there, that need to be treated differently. I noticed in one of the in the section on feedback and the criteria for success, I noticed in one of the examples you gave there were kind of evidence or signs of effort and care. And I think that's an interesting one, certainly something that I puzzled over when I was teaching year eights, mainly French and humanities. But I felt that often students would work out what the minimum requirements were, and only some would really go for it and take some risks, but also take care with their final work, with the quality of it and how it looked and so on. And I often thought about, you know, is that something that we should be including in our criteria, or is that just me, you know, sticking to old ideas about how you present your work? Do you know what I mean? So I'm sort of, what's more important, I guess. Yeah.
Well, and I think about, again, going back to the idea of the classroom community, when students see one another's work, when their work is visible, and they start to care about one another, and they start to have that relationship of trust that's everywhere, they're less likely to engage in minimum possible work. And then if we as teachers create opportunities for them to stretch themselves, you know, whether we make it cute and say, okay, well, here's the base model and here's the spicy version, and, you know, these are different options you have for how you could do it, or whether we encourage students to keep elevating their game by being aware of one another, because there are always going to be kids who do things that will inspire other people in the room, the teacher included. So when we have that kind of environment, you're not going to have as much of the, I'm just going to do the bare minimum and that's all.
Yeah, so you can rely on some of that relationship building that happened and the peer relationship building, mm-hmm. rather than
exactly.
Just
and the other thing is again, not taking it personally. And I know that sounds, teaching does feel personal. It's a very personal kind of job. But when a student does the minimum work required for your class, they're still showing up. They're still doing the work. And maybe what you perceive as being a minimum effort is actually them doing something more than that as well. So it can also be hard to perceive what they're thinking, which is why uncovering that as much as we can is important.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, and I think often too, well, for example, in language teaching, if you're fluent in a language, it can be hard to remember how difficult it can be at the beginning stages of a language just to grasp the most basic things like gender or whatever it might be. Conjugating a verb. And, you know, it's, I think as teachers, we have to keep reminding ourselves of what it means to start at the beginning, and how difficult that can be. Yeah. Okay, so you actually, one of the, I think you mentioned it briefly, but maybe you talk about learning menus as one way of giving students some more autonomy in the way they progress through course content. Could you talk a little about that, please?
Sure. There are a lot of different kinds of choice-based activities that we can give students. A learning menu or a choice board is one of them. Sometimes people like to do what they call playlists or hyperdocs, which are lists of links, or task boards. The idea is that students are all working toward similar learning goals, but we're giving them different ways to do it. So I think the example that I have in the book is it's a social studies unit, and they're studying the Roaring Twenties, and they're just a bunch of different ways that they could access the learning menu. And a learning menu is the sort of thing where, okay, well, you have, let's say, 12 activities on this menu. And by the end of this 2 to 3 week period, I want you to do 2 of them. So you can pick. So we have some that are built toward visual arts, like collages, or toward writing, like creating a news item, or design, a video game concept. And then there's also the more traditional options, like writing a paper or whatever appeals to students who don't want to get into that less traditional space. But the idea is that they are demonstrating their learning in a way that they can select that best fits their skills. Because one thing that used to really bug me as a teacher is that I would teach at the same time that I was teaching creative writing, which was a much more open-ended sort of class. I was also teaching curriculum-based English classes. And I sometimes had students in both classes at the same time. And I saw so much more from students, a totally different side of them, when they had more choices about what they could write. And so I thought, how can I open it up the same way in a class that's more dictated by a specific curriculum that's not as open? And so having these choice-based products really lets us see a child more and lets them show us what they can do, where otherwise they wouldn't have the opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think in a way, you know, you pose a question, you say, what is scary or intimidating about the idea of stepping back as a teacher? And it seems to me part of the scariness is that we think that if we haven't sort of stepped everything out, that students are going to miss something. So in the planning of choice-based activities like learning menus and playlists and so on, you know, what are your thoughts about the kind of approach to the planning of that? I mean, in terms of time, do you think this is something that takes more time to plan but then is rewarding in the actual activating and ends up reducing time in later on? Or do you think, you know, I mean, I guess what's the time commitment when it comes to planning this kind of thing?
So it doesn't have as big a time impact as one might think. And there are a couple of reasons why. The first is that when we plan activities for our classes, a lot of the time we're not planning alone. We're planning with a team. And so if I want to create a learning menu with 12 items on it, if I create 4 and my partner creates 4, you know, you can collaborate, or students can help to create them too. We're going to make a learning menu, and here's what our goal is, and what sorts of things would you like to see on it? So you could draw from the collective expertise of the people around you. And that's something I always encourage. But if you're working alone, if you're in a silo of some kind, and that does happen to some of us at times, it still doesn't have to take a whole lot more time, if any, because, and this was a real game changer for me when I started learning about choice options, it's what you are going to do anyway. It just presented a little differently. So I'm a big fan of Catelyn Tucker. She is a blended learning expert, and she calls it turning your agenda sideways, where you take everything that you are going to do, whether it's that day or maybe it's that week, and you turn it around so that everything that's on that agenda becomes an activity or a choice or a station. And so you're doing the same things you were always going to do, but you're just changing the presentation. And so in this unit on the Roaring Twenties, I was going to ask students to do a bunch of these projects anyway. It's just this time I might have put a few more choices on there, and they can pick how and when they do them, but they're still going to do the same number of things they were going to do. It just looks a little bit different. So it's just a way to reconfigure the vision of what we were going to do. And then as they're in stations, or as they're, you know, working in a very engaged way on what they've chosen to do, we, the teachers, have the freedom to move around or to focus on small group instruction or to prioritize certain students who are not where they need to be yet, or to empower students who are ahead to help students who are still working. All kinds of options begin to appear. And then we're not spending as much time at home or even in the classroom being quite so over-involved and hands-on in a way that is not as productive.
Mm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you talk about in Chapter 5, which is putting it all together, you talk about what you call the little details, which are things that kind of make this approach to teaching possible. And there's a lovely practical example that you give to do with encouraging students, all students, to contribute in some way to a discussion or a class activity, which involves index cards. Could you talk that through? Because I think it's a lovely one that teachers would find really useful.
That is, I believe it's a circle discussion protocol in which typically when students are doing discussions, you know, some students really dominate the conversation. So this is a way to really manage the conversation so that all student voices are being heard. So in this process, what you would do is you have a conversation topic that's really accessible for everyone. And every student walks in, you give them two index cards, and the index cards represent their comments. And when they make a comment, they throw the card into the middle of the room. And when they're out of cards, they're out of cards. They don't talk anymore. And that sounds very restrictive, but you can set other parameters, like you need to use at least one card. If we all throw two cards in the middle of the room, then we start again. But the idea is that you're really trying to increase equitable participation. You're trying to encourage all students to listen to one another. You're creating a space in which every voice has equal opportunity to be heard. And also, for the students who don't talk, obviously they're speaking more. But the students who usually talk a lot, they have to be a lot more careful about using those cards. So they also have to think about, is everything I say really contributing to this conversation, or can I be a little bit more judicious about how I share my thoughts? And, you know, there are just a lot of, there are other things you can use, there are other ways you can have that conversation, but that's just one suggestion for evening things up a little bit.
I liked that one, but I also started thinking I could imagine a kind of trade in cards, you know, the one who wants to speak.
Well, you have to make a rule, they can't do that.
Yeah. Are there any other ideas or little details in that chapter that you would like to share?
Well, one of my favorite things in that chapter is finding ways to help students really take advantage of their skills and to rotate them. So I have what I call a shared responsibility chart, and students sign up for roles. And for example, one of them is gamification guru. And this is something that kids who love to create online quizzes or work with those kinds of tech tools, they can create activities for the class at certain opportunities. Or I also have a feedback collector or a class discussion facilitator. So what we're doing is we're assigning kids roles, and they are ideally also rotating through them, because that way they can practice their different skills. And the idea behind this is that we all have skills. We all have things that we're stronger at and things that we're less strong at, and we're building one another's capacity, and we're also recognizing that we're all different, but that it makes us better as a whole. And so when we give students these opportunities to, you know, I used to do this in my classes. One of you is going to be the activator mastermind every week, and one day a week a student's going to design the activator, and we're all going to do it within certain boundaries. So you're really letting them showcase their skills in a way that adults would want to be showcased. And the other thing that really comes out of this last pulling it together chapter for me is that the epiphany that kids work like adults, which is that there's certain things they want to do in a certain order, and we don't usually give them that opportunity, but when we can, their work is going to be better because they're playing to their strengths. So anything we can find to give them a little bit more of that, we should try to do.
Yeah, it seems also it's an opportunity to encourage students to think about what order they want to do things in the sense of, do I do the thing I love first, or do I get out of the way the thing I'm not so interested in so that I can look forward to the thing that I love? You know, those little decisions that we make every day about, you know, how we'll organize our working life.
Yeah, because we do. I mean, I love having that kind of freedom that I didn't have when I was younger. And you know, if we really think about being kids, when we were kids, no one let us do a whole lot. You know, it sounds like such a, you know, we forget quickly how much we're not allowed to do.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I think there's so many excellent ideas in your book, and also a really honest acknowledgement of the mindset challenge that comes with this, but also, you know, by the end of the book, it makes you want to go and try stuff out and go, okay, I think, you know, clearly it's possible to make this work. How do I go about it? What are my steps? And so, you know, congratulations on that, because it's not always easy, I think, to reach teachers with all their doubts and their habits. So just to wind up, could you tell me what you're up to at the moment? Where are you headed next? What are your projects?
So I have two books in the pipeline, aside from this one. My next book, it's called Lead Like a Teacher. It's coming out in March of 2023. It's already up for pre-order everywhere. And essentially that book is about how can leaders incorporate the teacher perspective more to close what I call the empathy gap, which is what happens when you leave the classroom, you go into an office, and you stop being immersed in instruction. So how can we better those relationships with teachers and administrators and really do it for the benefit of kids and for our schools? That's my second book. And then I just started a third, and it doesn't have a title yet that I'm willing to commit to, but it really is building more off that idea of academic identity, which is how can we use writing instruction across content areas in a variety of settings to really build that student sense of self so they believe in themselves, that they're worthy, and that they're valuable to the point that they can take it beyond the classroom and into life. So that's something I feel very passionately about. And I'm really excited to be writing this third book because, first of all, it takes me back into the teacher perspective more. And second, because there was a lot that I didn't put in Teach More, Hover Less that I'd like to get in this one.
Yeah, I really look forward to seeing your next books. And just one last question, how do you fit the writing in with the rest of your life?
Well, I wake up around 4:30 in the morning.
Wow.
And I pretty much have, you know, an hour or two to myself before the rest of the world wakes up, and then I go to work and work all day, and then that's how that works. But it's the same way I got through graduate programs and every big thing that's ever happened to me, the 15 minutes a day rule, which is I just do a little bit every day. And so in this case, I have 1,000 words a day rule, which can usually happen inside of an hour.
I'm very impressed. 4:30 is very early.
It's early, but that's when I do my best writing. So I know that about myself.
Yeah, that's great. Well, look, congratulations on the book and all the best for the next ones. We'll keep an eye out.
Thank you. And I appreciate all the wonderful conversation, and it's been delightful.
Yeah, thank you, Miriam. And we hope to talk again sometime.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you.